Welcome to the Drop Time Report. Turn up the volume and listen to amazing stories about big bucks and the hunters who harvested them. Here is your host, outdoor writer, Tracy Breen.
On this week's episode, we're going to have on Nick Hoffman from Nick's Wild Ride. Nick's Wild Ride is a hunting television show that airs on the Outdoor Channel. But long before Nick got his start in hunting TV, he was actually a fiddle player for Kenny Chesney's band. So we're going to talk a little bit about traveling the globe with Kenny Chesney. Then we're going to break right into talking about how Nick travels the globe to chase big game animals. His show is kind of an adventure show where he goes all over the place in search of all kinds of different critters. We're going to talk about whitetails. We're going to talk about traveling around. We're also going to talk about the importance of mentoring hunters. Nick's family was not into hunting at all when he was growing up. It was actually a family friend that got him into hunting. And so it just goes to show you the power and the importance of mentoring the next generation. I'd like to thank my sponsors, Redneck Blinds. If you need a new hunting blind, check out redneckblinds.com. They make some awesome hard-sided blinds that everybody's familiar with, but what some people don't realize, they make awesome bale blinds. They also have ghillie blinds that look like a ghillie suit that blend in awesome in their surroundings. Fourth Arrow Camera Arms, if you want to film your hunt, and a lot of people do these days, check out Fourth Arrow Camera Arms. Windscent, makers of vapor deer scent technology. The guys at Windscent actually hired Tracker John to test and see how far away animals could smell vapor deer scent, and it was hundreds of yards away. The scent is actually heated up and dispersed in a vapor, and it travels a long, long way. So if you want to check out some new deer scent technology that hasn't been on the market that long, check out windscent.com. Morel Targets, certainly my favorite archery target, still owned by the same family, the Morel family there in Arkansas, moreltargets.com. Huntworth Gear, check out huntworthgear.com. And it's important to note, hey, maybe you like Kuyu clothes, maybe you like Sitka clothes, but we all need gloves, and we all lose our hunting gloves. So if you need a pair of hunting gloves and you lose them in the woods or whatever, check out Huntworth Gloves. They make some amazing gloves for early season, late season, and everything in between. You can pick them up at Walmart or a farm store near you. Pine Ridge Archery, makers of the Nitro Arrow Vane. Lucky Buck Mineral, my favorite deer mineral out there. I've been working with Lucky Buck for well over a decade. Grim Reaper Broadheads, they have some awesome broadheads. If you're in search of a great broadhead for bow hunting this fall, check out Grim Reaper Broadheads. Schaefer Performance Archery, makers of the XV Arrow Rest, an arrow rest that's been tested with high-speed camera and can get out of the way of the arrow traveling more than 400 feet a second. It's hard today for arrow rests to get out of the way of arrows simply because bows go so fast. The XV Arrow Rest is designed to get out of the way of the arrow even if it's flying faster than 400 feet per second. So check out Schaefer Performance Archery. Illinois Connection Outfitters in Pike County, Illinois. I'm actually headed there this week or next to hunt with David Blanton and a group from Realtree. Outdoorsman's, makers of awesome tripods for glass and big game animals, and backpacks. American-made Outdoorsman's. Last but not least, Wilderness Athlete. If you need to shed a few pounds, check out wildernessathlete.com. My favorite product they make, their Hydrate and Recover drink. Very little sugar. Just helps me recover after working out and helps me stay away from sugary drinks. Enter Drop 10 at checkout and get a discount. Now let's go ahead and get Nick on the show. Welcome to the Drop Down Report, Nick. How are you today?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Pretty good. How's life in Nashville?
It's that time of year where I'm not getting to see it and experience life in Nashville nearly as much as I would like. You know how it is. It's hunting season, man. I just got back from Utah. I'm leaving for Kentucky to Eastern Kentucky to elk hunt here in a couple days. So it's elk season, and I've already deer hunted once, dove hunted. I mean, we're full on into it at this point.
Yeah, you're living the dream, right?
Oh man, am I ever? I mean, for a guy from Minnesota, a little tiny town in Minnesota, who grew up, you know, wanting to play music and move to Nashville and be on the radio and then hunt in his spare time. That was my dream Well, I'm doing a lot more than that. So I consider myself to be one of the luckiest people on the planet, and I'm not afraid to admit it.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, right? You've chased some dreams. You and I have talked about that a lot in the past. Is I am where I am because I chased dreams that everybody thought was foolish, right? And I'm sure mm-hmm. when you were young, it was the same thing. You're chasing this country star dream, and you ended up, call it luck, hard work, whatever, you ended up playing fiddle for Kenny Chesney for many years. Just kind of highlight your break into Nashville real quick. This is a hunting podcast, but the first time you told me that, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool, like sleeping on park benches to chase the dream, right? So tell us that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's all connected. You know, if my hunting career is connected to my music career and vice versa, in a lot more ways than you might imagine. But the story you're alluding to is, you know, I have no recollection of not playing the fiddle. I come from a musical family. My grandparents were musical. They had jam sessions every Saturday at the Hoffman House, you know, and so I grew up around music. I have no recollection of not playing the fiddle. I've always tinkered with it. And then I started taking lessons when I was in like first grade or something like that. And so I've always played. And I always knew that I wanted to be a musician. That's what I wanted to do with my life. I'd stand in front of a mirror and I'd pretend to be Roy Acuff on the Grand Ole Opry. And, you know, I would sing karaoke at the bowling alley with my mom. And, you know, I just, it was always something. And then I started playing a fiddle contest and then started playing in bands. I knew that's what I was going to do. And I had a band called Crucial County that was a little bluegrass band when I was a kid. Like in sophomore and junior year of high school. And I started missing some days of school because I was out playing music. I ran it like a business. We were making a little money, but I was still getting good grades. I got called into the principal's office one day and he said, "You've missed too many days of school." I think it was a 10 days of aggregate of missing school. He said, "You're going to have to repeat your junior year. You've lost credit." And I said, "Well, I haven't done anything wrong. I'm missing school because I'm playing music and that's what I'm going to do for a living. And I'm also getting all my homework done and all my grades." And he said, "Well, let me tell you first thing, son, you better give up on that dream right now. You'll never amount to anything as a musician. You know, that's a stupid dream. And there's nothing I can do for you. And you're going to have to repeat your junior year." And for me, that meant that I was spinning my wheels. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to move to Nashville. That meant one more year of spinning my wheels. So that night I hopped a Greyhound bus and went to Branson, Missouri, and slept on a park bench and played for tips and just decided that I couldn't spin my wheels any longer. It was time to get my career started. And I went down there and just went after it. Now, looking back, that was definitely a lot of
craziness.
Young naivete. I had 60 bucks in my pocket, and I thought that was enough, would be enough. You know what I mean? I figured, oh, I can live on 60 bucks for a while. You know what I mean? And I learned really quickly that doesn't even get you a hotel room for a night. You know what I mean? So but that youthful naivete sometimes is a blessing because it catapulted me into a situation that shaped who I was and the connections that I made in Branson. And obviously I'm leaving a lot of the story out.
Yeah.
But the connections that I made in Branson ended up helping me move to Nashville, which ended up helping me get that gig with Kenny Chesney that you were talking about. And that gig with Kenny Chesney ended up helping me get my own record deal on Warner Brothers with my band, The Farm. And that ended up getting me on the Grand Ole Opry and on the radio and all the things that I always wanted to do. So, if it weren't for that move to Branson, I wouldn't tell you that all this wouldn't have happened, but I'm not sure that the same things would have happened and certainly not at the trajectory they happened. So, you know, I'm a big advocate for following your heart and following your dreams, even if it's a little extreme sometimes.
So just mention quickly that when you got connected with Kenny Chesney, nobody knew who he was either, right?
Well, he had a couple of hits, but he certainly wasn't the megastar that he is now. We were playing in clubs and small theaters and stuff when I joined. So to put it in perspective, within 2 years, we went from playing for theaters for like a couple thousand people to playing for a stadium full of 60,000. And you know, he's all of a sudden winning entertainer of the year. And it's the rocket ship that every musician dreams about, that movies are made of, you know, Almost Famous and movies like that. And all these biopics of these, you know, famous musicians are literally, I got to experience that firsthand with him, and it was incredible.
Yeah. Very cool. So that eventually leads to Nick's Wild Ride, which is a TV show on the Outdoor Channel. That's you, you know, traveling around the country and the world, chasing critters. And when people hear that story, they're thinking, yeah, this is a successful musician who gets to gallivant around the world. But something you and I have talked about is you're really after adventure. And in some cases, you're looking for those cheap adventures, because when producing a TV show, and this is what a lot of people don't realize, when producing an outdoor TV show, you're trying to make a living. You're trying to, at the very least, break even and make money. And in order to do that, you can't pay $20,000 for a moose hunt. It just doesn't mathematically make sense. So you've learned to cut some corners. Let's talk about that.
Sure. You know, the whole TV show is like a, if you haven't seen it, it's like an Anthony Bourdain style hunting show. So I go out to a destination to hunt, and I explore local food and history and music and culture and everything while I'm there. And the reason that show is the way it is and that it works for me is because it's very authentic. That's what I do anyway. I love to travel, and I love to travel to hunt. And every year before I had a TV show, I planned at least one, if not two, kind of adventure hunts, something new, something different. And while I'm there, I would explore, find the local beer or the local burger or whatever. So this is just an extension of me doing what I want to do. But like you said, it's a business too. And you're out there. Sure. I'm out there living my wildest dreams. And there's a lot of people who probably are very jealous of the life I live. But I also, like you said, this is how we make our living too. So we have to balance our passion for hunting with, you know, trying to be economical and trying to be, like you said, turn a profit, trying to actually make a living. And it's difficult at times. So I bring some pretty high-end international, you know, big ticket hunts to the table. And I have a budget for that every year. And that budget is set. It's a certain number of dollars that I have to spend for hunts every year. And so I have to kind of dole it out. And like you said, if I want to go on a moose hunt, I have to figure out how to go on a moose hunt and not necessarily do it at Jim Shockey price.
Yeah.
And so, cause Jim has to make a dollar too. So if you go hunting with Jim Shockey, you're probably not going to get a big discount. You know what I mean? So it's like, I've got to figure out how to do that. And what I've found over the years is that I think maybe TV shows have maybe done us a disservice in a certain way, because they've told us that we have to go to these outfitters in order to have a successful hunt, that we have to go to this big ticket guy. We have to go to this big outfitter. We have to go hunt with Jim Shockey to kill a big Yukon moose, for example. Don't get me wrong. I would love and will someday hopefully go hunt with Jim, but you know, that's not for everyone because they can't afford that.
Yeah.
What I've found is that there's a lot of opportunity out there. And, you know, if you want to go out and hunt a moose, or if you want to go hunt elk, or if you want to go hunt a big whitetail in Iowa, you can do it. And you might have to save for a year. It won't necessarily be free, but you can do it on an affordable level. And there's other things that I think we do a disservice. We talk about, you know, I'm talking about TV shows in general. We talk about big, huge antlered elk, which is what everybody dreams of. But man, honestly, a cow elk hunt is as difficult, if not more difficult, than killing a bull. And you get the same amount, if not more tasty meat out of the deer.
For sure.
And you can still get the same exact experience. You can still hike up the same mountain, ride the same horses, pack the same amount of meat out, and you can have that same thing, and you can do it for a couple of thousand versus $15,000.
I looked last night online. I mean, it's funny that we're talking about this completely, you know, separate from this interview. I was just looking at some private land elk tags last night, and New Mexico private land elk tag, $1,200
mm-hmm.
for a cow.
And you know, yeah. And you can find those things. All you got to do is be a little resourceful, and you got to think outside the box a little bit. And honestly, this is the case with my TV show too. Sometimes you got to lower your standards too. You know, you don't have to go kill an elk and Chama to have a great elk hunt. And there are a lot of places. I mean, my favorite elk hunt I've ever been on, I shot, you know, what most people would consider to be a dink of an elk on public land. And it's not always about that, those inches. It's about the experience, at least for me. And I know that sounds cliche, but it really truly is. And I say it a lot because that's how I feel. And the more I hunt and the more places I go, the more I realize that hunting should be as much about the adventure as it should be about the killing.
Absolutely.
And that's, I really believe that. Again, I know that sounds cliche, and I'm sure some people will.
Yes and no. You know, some of my favorite hunts, I remember hunting black bears up in Quebec and caribou in Quebec. And even if I wouldn't have killed a bear or a caribou, just the flight in, you know what I mean? Just flying in an otter or a beaver and landing on a lake and seeing the tundra from up in the air and all those kind of things. It was worth the price just doing that. And like a black bear hunt, they're way cheaper than anything else. And it is one heck of an adventure.
Absolutely. You can go on an odd-ed sheep hunt, which is getting a lot more popular, for a very small amount of money. And we call it the poor man's sheep. You'll get the adventure, the same kind of sore legs and sore back and shooting challenge. And, you know, and fatigue that you'll get on a high mountain Alaska sheep hunt for, you know, a tenth of the price.
And that's mainly Texas, right?
Like, yeah. Down in Texas, it's an awesome hunt, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. Another one's a black bear hunt in Arizona. Like, a lot of people don't even know that exists. You climb up into the mountains, into the flat, you know, the big, huge caves and stuff way up in the Arizona mountains to go after these black bear. There's some exciting adventures out there that a lot of people don't know about, because we get so whitetail centric in our lives that myself included, trust me, I grew up and I live and breathe whitetails at my place in Kentucky, you know, and I grew up with them in Minnesota, but I love to go on those adventures. And I really encourage hunters to step outside their comfort zone and go do something different. Because you'll come back, you'll be a better whitetail hunter if you go hunt something else somewhere else. I really believe that.
Sure. Let's talk about your Kentucky elk before we dive into whitetails.
All right.
You know, you've done that once before, right?
That's right. I did, and I'm making a documentary film on it. It's an incredible, story that they have there. You know what I mean? One of the great conservation stories of our lifetime.
How long ago did they first reintroduce elk?
Well, now it'd be about 22 years ago. I was lucky enough to get a tag, and which are hard to get, and hunt on the 20th anniversary of them releasing elk there. And, you know, what a lot of people don't realize, and I certainly didn't know it, is that there were elk everywhere in this country, from Minnesota all the way down almost into Texas. Actually, there were in Texas, all the way from New York to California. And, you know, in the late 1800s, mainly habitat, overhunting to a certain part, but mainly habitat loss, you know, clearing for farming and stuff. We wiped them out east of the Mason-Dixon line. The eastern elk is literally extinct. And they were a slightly different species because they lived in a slightly different, terrain. and they had to have a resistance to a brain worm that is in this in the eastern part of the states for ungulates. And so they're literally an extinct species. And so 20 years ago, they weren't the first state to do it, but they were the first state to do it right and well. Kentucky released elk from New Mexico and Colorado and Montana and a couple other states, and they've had a successful program that went from an initial 7 elk all the way to, I think they say they have, over 10,000 now. And so they have a huntable herd, that is, you know, you can get a tag, and non-residents can get it, and residents can get it, and they have a really successful hunt every year. And it's an incredible thing to think about, that we can actually reverse our mistakes as outdoorsmen and get out and do this. You know, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation was a huge part of that. Lots of other conservation organizations have jumped on board and have been a part of it since then. And it's just, you know, a lot of the idea that sportsmen are just out there killing stuff is, this is proof positive that that's not the case.
Yeah.
You know,
now with the Kentucky herd, let's say I'm a non-resident, I draw that tag, it's probably going to be a fairly inexpensive elk hunt, right? In comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. You can do it. The way it's really interesting, the way that the Kentucky elk herd thing works is most of the elk herd is relegated to reclaimed coal mine land. So once these, you know, these they do this strip mining on the surface for coal, and once that's the strip is, the seam of coal is gone, they cover it up, it back up in dirt, and they plant it in native grasses and all sorts of, you know, clovers and all sorts of stuff, and it makes incredible elk habitat. So all the elk herd lives on this reclaimed coal mine, and some of that's private ground. But the way the program works is that these coal companies open that ground up to the public for elk hunting. And so if you draw a tag, you have access to hundreds of thousands of acres of basically private ground for the entire elk season to go there and kill an elk. And so my first elk was, you know, self-guided. We spent, me and my buddy Craig both got tags, and so we camped in the Kentucky hills for I don't know, almost 2 weeks, and it was a hard hunt, and it was totally do-it-yourself public land hunting, and we both ended up getting elk within a day of each other, almost about the time we had about to give up. So, but we both scored, and it was an incredible experience. And it's really neat to see that program come, you know, full circle like that. And the more I got to know about it, the more I realized that I wanted to tell that story. So I've been working on a documentary about that program for almost 2 years now, and it's almost done.
That's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Let's
talk whitetails, you know, you've been able to travel around, and I told you, you know, before I interviewed you, be thinking about one of your favorite whitetail adventures, maybe a certain buck you've killed. I know you managed some ground in Kentucky, but, you know, is there a buck that kind of sticks out in your mind, and the story hopefully will, you know, teach the listeners something?
Yeah. You know, the first thing that comes to mind about my whitetail hunting is my very first whitetail hunt. I didn't grow up in a hunting family. Nobody in my family hunted. The only thing that ever got killed at my farm where I grew up was if my dad shot a fox that was after our chickens. You know, okay. That was it.
Yeah.
And so, but for some reason, I was always drawn to hunting. I was always drawn to the outdoors. I was the kid that was out in the woods by our house, you know, looking for tracks and, you know, trying to sneak up on squirrels. And, you know, I didn't realize that all those things were the hunter in me. And I really genuinely believe that some of us are, you know, wired to be hunters, and some of us are wired to be gatherers. There's for whatever reason, I always wanted to go do it. I spent my allowance on Field and Stream and hunting videos and stuff like that. But I didn't have anybody to take me hunting. And I was probably about 10 years old or so. And we had some people build a house, you know, not too far from us. And his name was Jim Zawistowski. They called him Zowie. And he had deer heads on his wall. And I thought that was the coolest thing. And I would ask him about this. And he had a mule deer and a bunch of whitetails. And he was the guy, if somebody hit a deer, he'd ask if he could take the meat. He loved venison. You know what I mean? And so I asked him if he'd take me hunting. And that season, I went and got my hunter safety certificate. And when I was 12, he took me hunting during rifle season, and he didn't kill a deer because he was trying to get me one. And we actually went during the black powder season in Minnesota, and he had a Kentucky long rifle, ball and patch. And so, you know, that was what he was going to take me out to kill my first deer with. And we hunted our butts off in southern Minnesota for days and days and days and days. And I remember that first night, that first, you know, morning, I guess it was dark in the woods, and watching it all come alive. And my heart was pounding before I even saw a deer. You know what I mean? I thought every sound I heard was a deer coming. And I was so excited. And we ended up not killing a deer on that first hunt. And yet it's still my favorite thing I've ever done. Because it was just so special. And if it weren't, and that ignited the fire, if it weren't for Jim Zawistowski, who helped me later end up killing a deer, I wouldn't be here, you know, and talking to you about this, if it weren't for somebody taking me out hunting. And so, you know, I go and I speak for SCI banquets and stuff like that now. And that's what I talk about is, you know, what are you doing to help somebody else like me? You know, because the chances are there's somebody, you know, that if you take a couple of hours or you take a couple of days and you take them out hunting, you could make a hunter for life, you know? And so I really believe in that. So my favorite whitetail hunt, ironically, is my first one where I didn't even kill a deer.
Okay.
You know, because it was so special. But beyond that, it started the fire. And then from there, it went and went and went, you know. And the first year, I didn't kill a buck until I was in my 20s. I killed does and stuff and whatever kind of brown it down type of mentality, because I didn't have a lot of opportunity. I didn't have ground to hunt. I didn't have a lot of people to take me out. So it wasn't until I got to go to Texas for the first time on a random thing that I got killed my first buck. And from there it started growing and growing. But my favorite buck I've ever shot was probably the last day of season in Kentucky, probably, I don't know, 15 years ago now. My buddy Craig and my brother-in-law Rob and I, every year on our place in Kentucky, we have a doe roundup at the end of the year. And we sit in a big, huge blind together, and we like an elevated blind that's insulated, and we call it the condo. My buddy Craig built it so that his daughter would go hunting with him, because she needs to be warm, and they have a little stove in there and the whole nine yards. It's like literally living in the condo. So we go in there and we set up a little heater and we shoot every, you know, as many does as we can, because we never kill enough does during the season, you know? So we all rack up probably at least one doe and we take them to the processor, and that's our burger for the year. Anyway, last day of season. And we're all hunting for does and we're making probably more noise than we should. And all of a sudden everybody quiets down and we see this buck, and it's this buck that we've known for years. He's probably 7, maybe 8 years old. We've never seen him on the hoof, and he's definitely going downhill. He's just a big 23, 24 inch wide 8 point. And he's just tall and just beautiful. And like I said, he's going downhill. He doesn't have the mass he used to, but we've never seen him on the hoof. We have pictures of him every single year since he's 2. And
wow.
he's like a ghost, you know, and out he walks into the field, and I'm the guy with the bow in the hand. We would rotate. So whoever was up next, and I just happened to be the guy with the bow in my hand. And also I can't remember, but I think I was the only guy with a buck tag. And out walks this buck. And I remember my buddy Craig saying, he'll never come over here, you know? And just like it was like he was on a string, he comes just straight past us. And I've never shook harder in my life than I did for this deer and for this animal, because I recognize that we may never, ever see him again. You know, and that's the beauty of these whitetails. You know,
so stop. Were you shaking harder than on stage with Kenny Chesney in front of 60,000?
I don't shake for that. That's okay. Fun, you know? Yeah. And so this deer comes and he ends up giving us a 40 yard shot with the bow, and I made a good shot. And you know, the rest is kind of this, it's all just this big gleeful memory with my two buddies. And how often do you get to be with your two best friends in a blind and have this bonus, you know, this thing you're hunting, and that's, you're there and you're having this annual experience with them. And then I got to shoot, you know, at the time, my biggest buck ever, with them right there with me. You know what I mean? And instant hugs and jumping around and everybody's excited. And on top of that, it was this special deer. So that's one of my favorite whitetail stories. I've definitely shot bigger deer, but that's one of my favorites because it's not very often you get to do it with your two buddies whispering at you, you know, right behind you.
Let's dissect that a little bit, the life of that buck. So you had watched him since he was two. I mean, as he got big and into his prime, did nobody try to like zero in on him, or was he just...
We did. We did. And the way that that farm, especially at the time, the way that we hunted that farm was very different than... And bucks like him made us begin to hunt that farm very differently. So we used to really focus on this one ridge and this one primary food plot that actually parts of it border the Mammoth Cave National Park, which is a really interesting thing. So, you know, we were able to pull some deer out of like, you know, a huge area of just, you know, premier virgin timber, you know, and we have food plots. So we would really, back then we'd really focus on this one specific food plot. And looking back, I think we probably could have got deeper into certain areas and tried to hunt after him, but we were always getting pictures of him in the food plot. And so we just kept thinking, eventually, if we hunt the food plot enough, eventually he's going to come out there in daylight. Mm-hmm. And so we would get out there and hunt him, and it just never showed up. And it wasn't that we had other deer too that we were after, you know, so everybody kind of ended up connecting on other deer, and every year he would just get a pass, right? We quit hunting usually probably by the time that he was showing up. And so, you know, but deer like him made us realize that we needed to start, you know, branching off from the food plot a little more.
Sure.
And getting deeper into the woods and finding those trails, you know, that we could try and find him on an hour before dark, rather than waiting right at dark for them to come into the food plot.
How big was he as his prime?
Oh man, as an 8-point, I bet he was a 145-inch 8-point, you know?
So really he never was anything besides an 8?
No, he was a straight 8, but he was 23, 24 inches wide. And that was what was so cool about him. You know, he had probably 12-inch twos, you know what I mean? Like big, you know, big, tall, heavy, wide 8-point. He was so wide. And that was so cool. By the time we ended up shooting him, he was fairly spindly. You know what I mean? He had gone way downhill.
How old was he when you killed him?
I think he was 7 or 8.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, and that last year, he really went downhill. And I remember us talking about it on camera going, man, it's a shame that we never got to shoot that buck at his prime, you know? And I love that. I love that part of the game. I love when you have a little bit of ground that you can focus on and you can watch the cameras and you can document the growth of these deer. And that's the stuff that people don't realize. They paint hunters as these bloodthirsty killers, but it's ironic that we really love the very things that we hunt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You get to know these animals, and whitetails especially, you know, you get to know them year after year. And if you're lucky enough to have a piece of ground to manage, you're letting deer walk, you know, and yeah, you're letting them live their life out, and you're letting them breed, and you're letting them do all this stuff. And this is stuff that people don't understand. It doesn't make any sense to them. It almost seems, and I guess it is, it's a little bit of a contradiction, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
We love the things that we hunt.
What's interesting too,
we have elk, that there are elk in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Because we love the things we hunt. We care. There, you know, there's the same reason that Quail Forever is, you know, helping quail get back in the South. It's because we love the things that we hunt. We care about them, you know?
For sure. What's interesting too about that buck, and I remember interviewing Lee Lukoski for this podcast, and he talked about on his farms, he always tells people when they reach, you know, 4.5, 5.5, if they pass by you, you know, shoot them. But he said oftentimes it's year five and six when they're really a giant, but you're really rolling the dice because once they reach that age, at any given point, they can start to go downhill. So you have a 5.5 or 6.5 and, you know, you're wanting to give him another year or whatever it is, and all of a sudden he just drastically goes downhill.
Yep.
And so it's amazing how they go from a monarch to heading downhill really fast.
Yeah, and, you know, it really is such an interesting combination of everything from water quality to food and, you know, genetics and all these different things that we maybe don't understand, you know, what it is that this is going to, what year this deer is going to go downhill. But boy, it really was marked with this deer.
Water is a big one. And being an elk hunter, you've probably noticed it. One of my favorite things to do is hunt elk out west in New Mexico. And from year to year, if there's not a lot of water for those elk, I mean, it really impacts the rack.
Yep. Absolutely. And, you know, we, this year on our farm, we acquired another little 80 acre chunk that actually was owned by another, hunter for years. And he had a deeded right away straight to our property. So you'd be sitting in the stand, you know, all of a sudden somebody else's four wheeler would come through, you know, and they were really nice people, but it was frustrating sometimes hunting. So we were able to acquire that little 80 acres this year. And it really completed our property because my buddy Craig bought it, and it's, most of this property is his, and I lease some of it. And we built a new food plot there. He did. I didn't have anything to do with it this year. I'll give Craig did all the work. I just get to hunt it, which is
okay.
Nice. He put the food plot in this year. I was on the road, but we went and put a new blind on it, the new redneck blind this year, and we put a buck palace there. And I hunted it opening weekend. And what's incredible is we've always known the bucks are in this area, but we've never really gotten hunted. And we've hunted the fringes of it. But literally, it was the first month of a new food plot being in there. And we immediately saw the benefit of it. And one of the biggest reasons I think that the buck quality is what it is down there is because there's always browse, and now there's going to be a food plot, but there's a beautiful, clear spring-fed stream going through there. And up on our ridge that I was telling you about, we don't have that. We have dirty kind of mossy ponds and stuff for water up there.
Okay.
But down here in this part of the farm, we have crystal clear water. And I personally think that we see a difference in the bucks in that part of the farm because, you know, in that part of the area, because of that really good, clear water that they have all year. I mean, that's just my personal little take. And, you know, it might just be little bits here and there, but if you think about it, that's just a whole lot less bacteria and a whole lot less stuff that those deer have to fight off. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And I think that makes a difference, and it might make a little difference, but the bucks just seem healthier. The deer seem healthier down there, you know?
Okay. Very cool. I want to close, you know, we're not always big on plugging products, but just a little background on our relationship. I had met Nick, I had met you a couple times, but really when we got to know each other was through one of my hunting clients, and that's Huntworth Clothing that I handle their marketing. And we came together there and worked a deal, and now you wear Huntworth Clothing, and you wear it in a lot of adventures and all over the world. And just kind of briefly talk about the quality of their clothing. And I don't want an infomercial, obviously, here, but for a price point, it certainly is one of the best out there. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, frankly speaking, I can't afford to, a lot of these hunts I go on, I can't afford to be in clothing that isn't, you know, up to the task. And what I've found the most interesting about Huntworth is that they put a lot of R&D into fabrics over there that still hit an amazingly affordable price point. So I've worn this stuff from the whitetail woods of Minnesota to the sheep mountains of Alaska, and it works. It just flat out works. And what's crazy about it is that you can buy an entire outfit, pants, layers, jackets, and gloves for a fraction of what just a pair of pants and a jacket would cost with other brands, you know?
Yeah.
And in certain ways, it's just as good. And, you know, and when it comes to when it comes to whitetail hunting, I think it's the best value and the best stuff out there. And I'm here to tell you that it stands up in a lot more than whitetail hunting. But man, when it comes to the whitetail woods, I don't think there's a better product out there for the money. There really isn't. I love it. And I love
it. It is amazing.
They have badass patterns. You know what I mean? The new Karnan pattern's awesome. I love the digital disruption camo. I mean, I it works. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
It just does.
It is amazing how high clothing costs have become, you know, and I mean, people literally are going on elk hunts or whitetail hunts and they're dropping, you know, $1,500 on clothes to go hunting. And
a lot more than that.
Yeah. And Huntworth is just kind of flying below the radar, you know, so check them out if you're listening and never heard of them, huntworthgear.com. So,
yeah, I love the stuff and I'm not afraid to say it. You know, I used to have that same kind of thing. I think we've been a little indoctrinated that in order to have good clothing, we need to go out and spend thousands and thousands of dollars. And that's just flat out not the case.
Yeah, for sure. Well, cool. When's your next hunt?
I'm going to head to Kentucky again. And I have an opportunity to join along on an elk hunt out there. So I'm going to go out and do a little elk hunting this following week. And then, from there I've got, then I start focusing on deer. You know, I'm going to do an episode in my home state of Minnesota. I haven't shot a deer in Minnesota since I was a teenager. And so I'm going to go back and go to deer camp with some of my relatives that I haven't seen since my grandparents died. And that's going to be really cool. I've got a awesome muzzleloader, tag in a great zone in Kansas for whitetails this year. And then of course I'm focusing on a big buck in Kentucky out of that redneck blind.
So there you go. There you go. Awesome.
Yeah, man. You know, with COVID this year, it's really screwed up some of my international stuff. And so that's a blessing because it's given me a chance to kind of do more whitetail hunting than I normally do. And I'm really excited about that.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Well, I appreciate your time today. You probably got to go play the fiddle or something. So I'll let you off here and have a good day.
Man, I appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you for what you're doing out there. And we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Take care.
See ya.
Bye-bye. Nick certainly is a fun guy. It was great talking to him today. And I'm looking forward to actually hunting with him in a few weeks. Before we end this episode, I want to do a giveaway. A pretty simple one. In the intro to the episode today, I talked about Huntworth gloves, how you can get those at Walmart and any farm store. Everybody loves having a good pair of hunting gloves that fit just right. The first couple guys that email me after this podcast, I'm going to send you a couple pair of Huntworth gloves, maybe a early season glove and a mid-season glove. So go over to my website, TracyBreen.com, TracyBreen.com. And just shoot me an email. I use that website mainly to book wild game dinners. So if you're looking for a wild game dinner speaker for this winter, shoot me an email. I'd love to talk to you. Until next time, have a great day and God bless.